Welcome to Shadows from the Tree, the podcast that invites you to explore the curious world of dark genealogy, uncovering secrets, scandals, crimes, and other darker events that shape family trees. Whether you're a seasoned genealogist, just beginning to explore your family history, a history buff, or even a crime junkie, we offer something for everyone. Join us, your hosts, Danielle and Michelle, in each episode as we share stories from over a century ago around a common theme. By using newspaper archives as our guide and conducting research using historical records, we piece together these often forgotten stories and gain a deeper understanding of the challenges those involved faced. Our hope is to connect you, our listeners, with your ancestors' past one story at a time. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, welcome back.
Yes, this is episode 5.
Yes.
We're doing it.
We're cooking along.
Yes,
this,
we are.
This season already.
Yeah, so it's very exciting. We were just chatting about kind of how we came across this topic, and, you know, we just celebrated Veterans Day recently, so we decided to kind of dig into war, because almost every single person out there listening, if you dig into your family history, you're going to find somebody who touched some type of war.
Exactly. And I think both of our stories, we were chatting, both our Civil War stories.
Yes.
So that's... You know, we always have some kind of thing where they overlap, you know.
It's good. I'm excited to hear, what you found. And I went into this looking for, like, something very specific.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you did, but
yeah.
I had a, okay, I interesting.
Yep. I'll tell you my search words.
Oh, good. Good. Your keywords. Yeah. I love it.
All right. So I was looking for Civil War love letters. Was
Ooh.
My search, and very strange result was the first thing that popped up. So it might be familiar to some people. It was featured as part of Ken Burns. You remember he does like a lot of those PBS documentaries.
Oh, PBS. Yeah, they
so
do a
we
good
had
job.
Done one in like 1990 specifically. It was I think it was 4 or 5 part about the Civil War.
Okay.
And this letter was part of it, was featured in the documentary, and he had, you know, someone read it, and there was music, so I believe he won an award for
really?
That documentary.
I'm sure you could probably find it online.
On PBS, you can watch it there. But, so Sullivan Ballou was born, get this, March 28th, 1829, in Smithfield, Rhode Island.
Close to home.
Right? It's really weird, right? So I just thought that was, you know, first name I clicked on was...
You're like, I'm doing it.
Yeah, this is it, I guess. I told my husband, he's like, well, that's, you know, that's pretty straightforward.
Meant to be. I do believe in fate.
So he was actually, you know, his dad died when he was a youngster, so his family didn't have much money. He got kind of like a sponsorship to study. He actually studied at Brown University and later graduated from the National Law School in New York. So early on in his life, he married Sarah Shumway in 1855, and they did have 2 sons together, Edgar and William, and they lived, you know, a quiet, family-oriented life. He was a lawyer and a politician.
Okay.
So he was, you know, deeply committed to the Union cause. He served as Speaker of the Rhode Island House of Representatives. He's also known for his eloquence. He actually had a job as an orator, so he taught... like, you know, speech giving, and
he
was pretty well accomplished and well educated, and he was a staunch supporter for Abraham Lincoln.
It just boggles my mind how, like, we're talking about such a long time ago, and how well people did for themselves back then.
Yeah, he had a really, you know, good career. So he did make the decision to join the Union Army, and that was stemmed in a strong belief in preserving the United States and opposing slavery. So in 1861, the tensions between the North and the South had escalated. So Ballou enlisted in the Army, becoming a major in the 2nd Rhode Island Infantry Regiment. So he was, you know, conflicted about leaving his wife and his family, but he felt, you know, that profound duty to serve his country and support Abraham Lincoln. So there was the first battle of Bull Run. This was on July 21st, 1861. So this was near Manassas, Virginia.
Oh, this is great.
Is it the same battle?
Mine does include a bull run at Manassas.
Okay. Well, here we go.
It
was one of the earliest major battles in the Civil War. And despite initial Union successes, the Confederate reinforcements turned the tide, so leading to a devastating Union defeat. So during a chaotic retreat, he was actually mortally wounded by a cannon fire. So a cannonball struck his horse and killed his horse under him and like took his leg off.
Oh, geez.
And then so he ended up in a local like infirmary, like a hospital, but he didn't make it. He died like 7 or 8 days later. So accounts suggest he had suffered that, you know, severe leg injury.
And did you say about how old he was? Because he had kids, right?
He was born in
You said
29. So this was in 61. So math, you know.
29, 61. Yep. Like 32.
32. Yep. 32. I've seen. Yep. Here it is. All right. And even after the battle, though, the Confederate forces reportedly were desecrating the graves of the Union officers. So and they thought they had gotten Ballou's commanding officer's body, and they were doing, not.
Jeez.
Yep. Very so they were exhuming the bodies, and they were burning them in an act of vengeance. And so Sullivan Ballou's was, his remains are part of that desecration by the Confederates.
Jeez.
So it like further amplified Ballou's status as a symbol of the Union patriotism and the horrors of the war. So the story, the love, let's get to the
love letter, a little something uplifting.
Yeah, this is a love letter here. So we already know that he doesn't make it, but he writes to his wife very often. So there's detailed accounts. They have them in the archives in Providence.
Wow.
Not this one particularly. So this one's a little, we'll get into the controversy about it, because he, you know, he writes in a specific style, and some think that it might not match his style, and maybe someone else wrote it. So we'll get there. But so this was written July 14th, so just a week before, you know, his death in 1861. So he writes, "My dear, my very dear wife, indications are very strong that we shall move in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. Lest I should not be able to write you again, I feel impelled to write a few lines that may fall under your eye when I shall be no more. Our movement may be one of a few days' duration and a full pleasure, and it may be one of severe conflict and death to me. Not my will, but thine, O God, be done. And if it is necessary that I shall fall on the battlefield for any country, I am ready. I am no more misgivings about or lack of confidence in the cause in which I am engraved, and my courage does not halt or falter. I know how strongly American civilization now leans upon the triumph of government, and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and suffering of the Revolution. And I'm willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all of my joys in this life to help maintain this government and to pay that debt. But, my dear wife, when I know that my own joys, I lay down nearly all of yours and replace them in this life with care and sorrows. When after having eaten for long years the bitter fruit of orphanage myself, I must offer it as their only sustenance to my dear little children. It is weak or dishonorable while the banner of my purpose floats calmly and proudly in the breeze, that my unbounded love for you, my darling wife and children, should struggle in fierce through useless contest with my love of country.
Wow.
I cannot describe to you my feelings on this calm summer night when 2,000 men are sleeping around me, many of them enjoying the last, perhaps, before that of death.
Oh, and, my gosh.
And I, suspicious that death is creeping behind me in this fatal dart, and communing with God, my country, and thee. I sought most closely and diligently and often in my breast for a wrong motive in the hazarding the happiness of those I loved, and I could not find one. A pure love of my country and of the principles I have advocated before the people, and the name of honor that I love more than I fear death, have called upon me, and I have obeyed. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence can break. And yet my love of country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me irresistibly on with all those chains to the battlefield. The memories of all the blissful moments I have spent with you come crowding over me, and I feel most deeply grateful to God and you that I have enjoyed them so long.
Aww.
And how hard it is for me to give them up and burn to ashes in hopes of the future years.
Oh my God.
When, God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and seen our boys grow up to be honorable men.
Oh, sad.
Right? Just so sad. He just keeps going too. It's so sad. I know I have but a few claims upon divine providence, but something whispers to me, perhaps it is a wafted prayer of my little Edgar, that I shall return to my loved ones unharmed. If I do not, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I love you, nor that when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name.
Oh my God. That's so sad.
Right? Forgive my many faults and my many pains I have caused you. How thoughtless, how foolish I have oftentimes been. How gladly would I have washed away your tears, every little spot upon your happiness, and struggle with all the misfortune of this world to shield you and my children from harm. But I cannot. I must watch you from the spirit land and hover near you while you buffet the storms with your precious little fright. And wait with sad patience till we meet to part no more. But, O Sarah, if dead can come back to this earth and flit unseen around those they love, I shall always be near you in the garnished day, and in the darkest night amidst your happiness scenes, and the gloomiest hours always. And if the soft breeze fans your cheek, it shall be my breath.
Aww.
Or if the cool air cools your throbbing temples, it shall be my spirit passing by. Sarah, do not mourn, my dear. Think that I am gone and wait for me, for we shall meet again. As for my little boys, they will grow as I have done and never know a father's love and care. Little Willie is too young to remember me long.
Oh, sad.
And my blue-eyed Edgar will keep my frolics with him among the dimmest memories of his childhood. Sarah, I have unlimited confidence in your maternal care and your development of their characters. Tell my two mothers, I call upon God's blessings upon them. O Sarah, I wait for you there. Come to me and lead thither my children. Sullivan.
Oh my gosh. Like, so well written, right? First of all.
Yeah.
And to have that much composure. Yep. I just picture him sitting there, right? Like, yeah. To have that much composure to write that.
Yeah. Writing it in candlelight, thinking about all the men sleeping around him and how, like,
he, just a feeling, yeah, knowing it.
He felt like this was it. This for
and that was
reason.
The last letter?
Yeah, that was the last letter. Yep. They say that it was found in a trunk. It wasn't found like on him or anything, yeah. But it was found in a trunk of his belongings.
Oh, so he never made it out to her?
No, not right away. No, it was found later on. So they were like, that's what kind of, there's some, you know, controversy.
Right, right.
So if he didn't write it himself, he had a really good friend who was with him and Camp Clark. That's where they were stationed, mm-hmm. the night before or the week before. And his name was Rogers, I believe. Yeah. Horatio Rogers Jr. Okay. He was also, you know, very well educated, great storyteller. He wanted to memorialize his fallen, like the fallen soldiers.
I just feel like you can't write, like,
and it had too much emotion.
It did, like, yeah. Thinking about your children, your wife.
Yeah, like, and he says he wasn't, like I said, his father had died when he was young. So,
wow, you must have, when you first found this, you must have just been like, keep reading, keep reading, keep reading.
I was like, and then I had to look. I was like, oh, did she remarry? Like, how did that go?
Right. Yeah.
Oh no. Nope.
She never remarried.
Never remarried. She was. I guess that was her one true love. Yep. So she lived until 1917, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yep. So it was discovered among his belongings, but, you know, they're not sure if it was written by him because it doesn't match, like, the tone of his other letters, but maybe
he just felt like
something come over him, that
right.
impending doom feeling.
Right. Like, that was to him his last letter door. And you would, of course, write differently feeling that.
Yeah. Not like a suicidal note, but same kind of like connotation, I guess, like a goodbye instead of a check-in, you know?
Right. Yeah. Like, things are okay. We're here at camp. Yeah. No, this was like a final, a final letter. Wow. That's amazing, though, that could be saved in history.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
You know, love is kind of eternal. Like, you know, not everyone feels it, but if you're lucky enough to feel that with someone else, it just, you know how that feels.
Yeah.
And like not even wanting to imagine losing someone that you're that close to, because
right, that pain, it's
pain is just,
and he was so torn in the sense that,
yeah,
you know, he knew the
cause, yes, but he knew what he was losing and what right, what was gonna, because he didn't have a father, he knew what his sons were gonna have to go through. Sad. So it was even more of a parallel kind of,
yeah. Did you go down the rabbit hole of the sons, like did
I
they
did.
Live
a- I did. So they both married. The oldest son didn't have any children. The okay. younger son married a woman who already had children. Okay. So he married later in life. So they didn't have any direct descendants okay. after that.
Aww.
Yeah.
Wow. That's.
He does have a nice memorial. We can go in Providence if we oh. wanted to go look at his.
Wow. We might memorial. Have to make a yeah. field trip.
Yeah. Because they brought his body back. I guess she was living in Woonsocket with okay. with her children. So they brought the body back to Woonsocket after he passed. Wow.
Oh, it was such a time. I mean, although, you know, there are current day, you know, as we just celebrated
here's
Veterans
the
Day. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, there's some good pictures.
Wow.
So he's in his uniform and her, and then there's a picture of her and like all the buttons and her hair.
Oh my gosh.
His thumb up. But, yeah,
that's crazy. Yeah, that's, I mean, people who have currently served in war, they obviously can probably relate to the feelings.
And then there's look at that. A picture of them before they went, so this was in July of 1861, and then there's a painting in the archives of the battle at Manassas, the Bull Run. So yeah,
That's a great one, because I think back to like my grandparent, obviously our, you know, yeah. you're married into the family, our, yeah. our grandparents.
Yeah.
I have all of their letters that I put in chronological order, because they used to leave, my grandfather's family had a milk business. And right. when he would go leave the milk on the doorstep, he would leave a love note under there. Mm. And I mean, there's at least 30, 40, and I put them in order yeah. and I was able to like kind of read them. And it was a simple things, right? Like,
right.
I can't wait to see you and go for a walk. Like just yeah. so simple. And it was, yeah, felt like true love. It was, yeah, amazing.
I really like the story. I wish it had a, you know, a different
ending
but it
yeah.
kind of, it felt like he knew what was,
yeah,
what was going to happen. And
he couldn't have had that much emotion to write yeah. that particular piece yeah. down on paper.
It was really, I think it was meant to find this story. I don't
yeah.
know. It might be more well known than I think, but
I've never heard of it. Yeah, and especially either. Seeing as he's
local.
Yeah. Right? Local and buried in Rhode Island. I mean,
it really hit me. This story was a good
so
find.
Close.
And it just jumped right out at me, right? Right, you know, when you start, sometimes it takes forever to
oh, yeah.
get a good one. But yeah. it was just like
boom.
Instant match. It was a,
yes.
a good find. And I think about Sullivan Ballou and Sarah.
Aww. Yeah.
So
that's a great one to share. And even though he didn't have any descendants, you have like stepfathers, you have
yeah.
like great, you know.
Cousins. I think
yeah,
there was a cousin that had some of the like other letters. So
oh, wow. Nice.
They were sharing them with
I'm going to have to go find that PBS.
Yeah.
Show.
I think episode. You have to subscribe. I tried to watch
oh, yeah.
it. You have to like subscribe to PBS. I was like, I don't have much time for this
I know,
week,
right?
But maybe eventually I'll
put that on
I'll
the listen. Future to do.
I'm sure I'll just cry, Liz, because
I know. I now you
put,
feel
like,
immersed in
background
it.
Music on
some, oh, yeah.
someone reading it and you're just
oh no, yeah, that's a lot. But it sounds in we'll have a viewing night.
Yeah.
We'll have to do a viewing night.
We will.
But,
right, what's your story
okay,
about?
So it's funny. I just had that chuckle earlier because it's very similar in the sense of the time period and then yep. just also a few other things that you'll notice. So I was looking for an article specific on a veteran who was a woman.
Nice.
Because I remember, like, we're going way back to, like, high school. I feel like there was, I don't even remember the name, but we did, like, a research on someone who, you know, disguised themselves as a male and fought in the war. And I was like, right. that's just fascinating. And, you know, nowadays we have men and women in the military forces. And shout out specifically to my sister-in-law who's in the Coast Guard, my brother-in-law in the Coast Guard. I have a you know, inherited cousin in the Marines and an uncle in the Marines. So, you know, this can relate to probably a lot of people, and I just think this story is awesome. So I found it, and it was in the Akron Evening Times out of Ohio, okay. And it was dated December 28th, 1895. And it was a very small headline. It was called Plucky Katie Brunell, and but had a sketch photo. So of course I was in
picture.
It.
We love a we love a face with a name.
Yes, and so she is a veteran of the war and a member of the Grant Army, was also how it was kind of sublined. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I started just digging right in. And the first sentence that I read was, Katie C. Brunell is a woman, but despite her sex, she's a veteran of the late war and a member of the GAR. Her story came out very recently when she applied for the position of matron in the New York Park Department. So I limited myself to how many articles I found because, you know, it can get just crazy.
Right.
So I found like 5 or 6, and they all are somewhat similar, but kind of spread out over time. So this was like the earliest that I found. And so her early life, she was born in 1842 in a tent on a British army camp in Kaffraria, South Africa, if I said that correctly. She was the daughter of a Scottish father, George Southwell, and of a French mother who shortly died after childbirth. So, you know, sad part there. Yeah. But she, so her name was Katie, spelled K-A-D-Y, Southwell. And in an article from the newspaper in 1905, it stated that her name was in honor of her father's friend, who was a fellow officer named Sir James Cady. I'm like, that's nice. Makes sense why it would be spelled K-A-D-Y too. Like, seems very personable. So soon after, you know, she was born, she was put into the care of a family, Duncan and Alice McKenzie, who eventually immigrated to Providence, Rhode Island.
It all comes back home, doesn't it?
And I read, like, I didn't first read that part until a couple articles in, but I was just like, like, now it feels even like you. I was like, yep, this story is now what I'm doing. Yep. So she comes over, and in the first census I could actually find of her was from 1860. So she's listed as Katie McKenzie, 19 years old, living in South Kingston. And the birth, like, the information matches the birthplace, the father's name. It says she's a weaver in the Providence Mill.
Okay.
So we have that, and then we kind of jump a little bit where she gets married. So I see the marriage index for Providence of November 7, 1863, but then I see on like a later document that is of the husband that they were married April 1st of 1861, which kind of aligns a little bit more with my story. So debatable. But in the marriage record, it said she was 21, and again, the father, Duncan McKenzie, Alice McKenzie is the mom, but there was no like official like adoption or anything like that. It's just they kind of took her under her wing, their wing. So she married Robert S. Brunell, who was listed as 28. This was his second marriage, and I found through a record that they, through his first marriage, there was a son, Eugene Brunell, who died. The mom, I believe, died in 1859.
Okay.
There's a rabbit hole I had to stop myself from going down. I'll get back to that. But I think if she died in 1859, it was probably due to the childbirth of, you know, Eugene. And it listed him as living in South Kingstown, which lines up with her living mm-hmm. there. So they probably met when she kind of moved there. So the there was one article that I kind of liked because it was from the Cincinnati Post, written in 1911, and it was titled "Woman Veteran of the Union Ranks." Union ranks spent her honeymoon on the battlefield, so which you know, I was like, "This lady,
it's an adventure,
yes, she's doing it." But it's true. So, I read a little bit like on the battles and things like that, but I did find this book, and you could read it for free on Google. It's called Women of the War, Their Heroism and Self-Sacrifice, and it's written by Frank Moore and published in 1866. So from what I can tell, this is a book that wasn't too far gone. Yeah. So you could actually, I feel, get pretty accurate information because it's not like told through the grapevine, right?
Right. Yeah, so getting firsthand accounts.
Yeah. Which is good. And there was a whole little chapter on her.
Nice.
Start on page 54. And I'm just going to read a couple of the things because it really just, to your point of your letter, makes you feel what it was like.
Paints the picture. Yeah.
Yeah. And so her husband, so how it all started was her husband was made orderly sergeant of the 1st Rhode Island Infantry. So not the second, but the first, and which they were only supposed to be for 3 months. And she decided she was going to go along and be with them. So you know, one of the little clips said, when the company went out to practice daily at the target, she carried her rifle as well as the colors. And when her turn came, the men seldomly restricted her to the 3 shots, which were allowed to each. They were pleased with her skill and coolness with the weapon, that she was allowed as many shots as she chose, and thus became one of the quickest and most accurate marksmen in the regiment.
Nice.
I know. It's cool.
A little extra practice.
Yeah. And then it said, when the regiment moved, she sought no indulgence on account of her sex, but marched in line beside her husband, wearing her sword and carrying the flag. She remained in the line, guarding the colors, and thus giving a defined point on where the men could rally. As the skirmish deepened into a general engagement, there she stood, unmoved and dauntless, until the weathering heart, and amid the roar and blood and dust of the terrible July day. So this is specifically about the battle happening, and she has the colors, so everyone knows where they should go, and she's just standing there, like, in her spot, not even, you know, yep, holding the ground.
Very brave.
Very brave. And to be so young, too. Like, yeah. Then it kind of talks a little bit after the Union line had been broke, and it wasn't until a soldier in a Pennsylvania regiment who was running past seized her by the hand and said, "Come, sis, there's no use to stay here just to be killed. Let's go into the woods." She started down a slope with him towards a pine thicket. They had run hardly 20 steps when a cannonball struck him full on the head, and in an instant he was sinking beside her, a shapeless and mutilated corpse. Yikes. His shattered skull rested a moment on her shoulder, and streams of blood ran over her uniform.
That is awful.
It just, like, just paints, like, you feel like you're there, right?
Yeah.
So, to me, she's in it. She's not just on the sidelines.
No, she's in battle.
She's in battle. And so after that battle had taken, she made it through.
Yeah.
So their first 3 months was up with or expiring at that time. And after that, there was a little bit of time gaps, but she and her husband both reenlisted in the 5th Rhode Island Infantry. And also, this is when I read the research of Bull Run, but I don't know how it all kind of went from a timeline. And she was still the color bearer, but also was acting as a nurse and was considered the daughter of the regiment.
Okay.
So she also was considered a hero in my mind because there was one battle that was happening where she saved a lot of people, innocent people, by running out in front with her colors in hand and advanced to clear ground and waved them till it was apparent that the advancing were friends. So the same people fighting for the same thing were actually going against each other, and she had to be like, listen, no. It's us.
We are together on this.
Yes, yeah. So, and it was in that battle, it even stated how, like, she made it back from there and she was hearing whispers from all these people about her husband. Oh, he didn't make it. Oh, he took away on his horse. Like, she was just hearing all different things.
Oh, wow.
And then end up finding him, and she was helping on the nursing side and healing side. And she even was noted to be nursing some of the rebels as well. Mm-hmm. But it was that point where Robert did get injured badly, and he was unable to continue, and he wasn't able to enlist anymore because of his injuries.
Yeah.
And so they put him on a steamship, or them on a steamship, after he was well enough to to be able to walk, and that's when they kind of went to New York. So it took about 18 months, I think it said, for him to actually be up and running. Yeah, recover from his wounds. And Katie was always by his side as a devoted, loving wife, it said, and a kind friend. Yeah. So not only was she, let's just say, kicking ass on the battlefield, but she, you know, she had the humanity to care for everyone as well. So those were just, definitely tell people if you're interested in reading stuff on war, this book was a very easy read. Like, they didn't, you know, sometimes when you're writing back in 1866, it can be a little different, but it was very easy and very intriguing. So that was them. And I've got pictures.
These, I think, are
her posing after the fact.
Oh, wow.
And that's her and her husband.
Very cool.
Yep. And they're actual photos.
That's great.
This is like some of the sketches and things like that in the newspaper. But
no, I love that.
Well known for people, I guess, who are interested in that sort of thing. So then we kind of just jump at, you know, kind of like what was life after a war for them. She actually got a pension card.
Oh,
so
cool.
She, following the Civil War, she was at that time the only female to receive discharge papers from the Union Army. And in 1884, the U.S. government granted her a pension. She only was getting $8 a month, supposedly, from this one document. And her husband was getting $24. But we actually have, like, on Ancestry, like, her pension card. Tells you the date of the filing. Tells you, like, the Rhode Island Infantry, name of soldier,
yeah,
Grinnell Caddy.
Many women cards. It's all
women. Isn't that cool?
Soldiers. Yeah, that is really cool. Good for her. Stinks that she wasn't paid the same.
I know.
The inequality goes
goes way back. Yeah, but she's paving the way, right?
Right.
She's totally paving the way, which
definitely,
which we love. And then from like 1870, you see them living in Bridgeport, Connecticut for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then in 1880, they're back in New York. He's a carpenter and she's keeping house. And they live there up until her death. So in 1895, she enters the Park Service and she becomes the caretaker of the Jumel, I might be saying it wrong, a mansion in New York. And there's actually a picture of them like at the garden of this mansion in New York. So we're like taking care of it.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and they're like, they're definitely older, right? They got
living
a dog
a
by her side.
Life. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool.
From the battlefield to the garden.
Seriously.
Aw.
That's so true. And then in 1913, there was like a New York Tribune newspaper article that said, "Women veteran 71 sent to rear. Caddy Brunell ordered to Ward's Island because of illness." And it just spoke about like her year-long illness and how she was going to be landing in the soldier's home in Oxford, New York. So she died there on January 5th, 1915, and there was a funeral held in New York, but the body was taken on a steamboat, it said, and burial services took place at North Burial Grounds in Providence.
Oh.
So we're doing a field trip.
Maybe they're in the same.
Same.
Oh, my gosh.
That would be interesting. But this is where, again, that rabbit hole kind of takes place, because she's buried at a site that's with his ex-wife.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I say ex-wife,
no,
because that's the other theory.
Widowed, though, I thought, no?
Yeah, but there's actually mixed. I saw like 50-50 data. Some say she was divorced and like moved and remarried.
Mm.
But on this headstone, it does say 1831 to 1859. So to me, I feel like she died just right before they met.
Right.
But like people had like a lot of evidence that seemed that she moved away. But this is the weird thing. It says Robert Brunell, right, the son, the husband.
Mm-hmm.
It's like on the gravesite where his like death date is like, I don't even know, covered up. And I don't think it's just the photo. I think
weird.
It's like actually covered up.
Like blacked out.
And I thought I read something saying that he was like in an unmarked grave.
What
and
does
then
find a grave say?
It says North Burial Ground, but on his death certificate, which seems to align, I didn't get to like really, I literally just found it before I came here.
Mm-hmm.
It says he was in PA, and I'm wondering if he went there for, because he was also ill. Because I saw a few things about him having to go to a soldier's home as well, and it lists a different cemetery. So I'm just all confused. I'm going with the theory that the first wife died, but I still don't understand why his, like, it's, like, covered up like that. It's very, and you can, here, I'm trying to blow up the picture. You can't really. But even there, that looks like actual,
yeah, someone
like, actually on the stone. So now we're really going to have to go there and look at it.
That is strange.
So, anyways, I felt really good about Katie's story. I think she was an amazing person who, again, paved the way for many people.
Trailblazer.
Yeah, I found a few other names and stuff of women. Mm-hmm. But this one just hitting home, I was just like, yeah, this is what an interesting story. Like, literally born at an army camp.
Yeah.
And then fighting.
Yep. It was in her blood. In a war.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's my story. And, you know, we're definitely going to post some of these photos and start brainstorming what's next. What's next week?
Yeah. Good stories this week. Well, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.